Welcome, everyone, to the third episode of Lewis Brisbois' AI Arena podcast, Skate to the Puck. Today, we have a very special guest that we're excited about, and you should be too. We have Nir Pellet, who currently is the Senior Director of AI Products and Business at the Intel Corporation. And Darren, if you can explain, why are we talking to Nir and what is the theme of this episode?
Well, the theme of it, we thought, would be back to Genesis, because we've been talking about AI, where it is, how it already is here, and how it's transforming lives. Every day, we're reading something new about AI-generated models making things more efficient for every sector of society. And everyone seems to be drinking from the fire hose from this, from the tech industry to industries that are going to be using it to nonprofits and community organizations to individuals, and of course, to governments all over the world. Policymakers in every regulatory center, they're trying to understand this. Everyone I talk to kind of says, well, gosh, I'm still scratching my head, and I think I'm only scratching the surface of what this stuff can do. So as we've been examining how different industries and different sectors of society are responding to the awesome potential benefits of AI and worried about whatever risks might come with AI and how do we balance that, we thought it would be good to go back to Genesis and find somebody like our esteemed guest, Nir, who has been involved with this technology as it's been evolving for years and can explain to us in hopefully layman's terms what this is, how it all got rolling, and where we're headed maybe.
Right. And so, you know, Nir, I'll start it with you and you can give a brief introduction of your background. But I have a very simple question. What is AI? If you could answer that in 2 minutes, that's great. How did it get started?
It's interesting question. Artificial intelligence, right? It talks about intelligence, about things being smarter and usually associated with humans, not even animals, or we refer to some animals to be more intelligent than others, right? Fish, dog, right? And now we're talking about machine having an intelligence. What does that mean? There's a whole philosophy branch around levels of intelligence. What does it mean to be? How do you measure that? So different ways of measuring by different ways of definitions, you'll get different answers. The general, I guess, direction right now is that machine learning and artificial intelligence are families of algorithms, mathematical algorithms executed by computers that are not fixed formulas. I'm simplifying the heck out of it, but it's not X equals Y or else terms and conditions, but here is a lot of examples. Try to learn from this behavior and either predict or help us classify it better or help us find patterns. So not exclusively directing the machine to do something, but allowing it to learn by itself. For mathematician, to me, is study engineering for many years and math and so on. What helped me a lot to understand the concept was when you try to build a formula to a function, you work very hard and you'd use all kind of mathematical tricks to find a function that does one thing. With AI, you get a similar result by just letting the algorithm figure out what's the right function. So for example, if you have, in our case, if I use realistic use cases, if I show a machine my behavior on Netflix, like what do I choose, what I didn't choose, where did I spend time on, where I didn't spend time on, what did I click, thumbs up, three thumbs up, thumbs down, what did my wife, what was she watching, did we watch, all of this information, I can understand about me and I can build an algorithm that will recommend the next video for me, give me a better experience. Using machine learning algorithms, and AI is kind of the bigger umbrella of machine learning algorithms, just letting the machine observe my decisions or my behavior allows it to understand me. So I didn't explicitly build an algorithm or function for me, but I let the machine understand that. That's kind of in a short way, trying to explain what that means.
No, that's helpful. And I guess the question is, everyone jumped at this, I think, when ChatGPT came out. That's when a lot of people first heard about AI in, you know, the end of 2022 and beginning of 2023. But it seems like it's been around longer than that. Is that correct?
Yeah, but let's talk about when it became real, like really impacting the industry.
Yeah.
It was in academics since a long time. It's mathematics, right? It's algorithms. Artificial intelligence is something that was studied for years. First papers came in the early of the last century. To me, the tilting point happened in 2012. Around 2012, there is a competition called around ImageNet, which is thousands of pictures, all kind of pictures. And the competition is around algorithms that are able to classify those pictures. Classify meaning you show a picture and it would say, oh, it's a dog, it's a cat, it's a flower, it's a tree, maybe even the brand of the dog, and so on. So there's limited numbers of classes, dog, cat, tree, and so on, and random images. Those images, you know the answer. Somebody, we call it labels. Somebody looked at the picture and wrote in the back of the picture, there is a husky dog jumping over a fence. And in the competition, the algorithm sees the pictures, get the pixels, and guess the classes in this picture. Up until 2012, it's called computer vision. There were a lot of algorithms to do that. Some are better, some are worse, and it was compared to the quote-unquote human capability, which is roughly 95% or so to do that. That's very easy for us. What happened in 2012, there's one of the, they call it the grandfathers of AI, like one of the gurus, the prestige name, Jeffrey Hinton, joined a competition and for the first time used deep neural network and used the GPU. So the first time those two things were used in tandem, so the algorithm that he used, deep neural network, which is AI, to think of the, it was the, when you look at evolution, it was an amoeba compared to the large language models we're talking about today. It's a much, much smaller model, but it used convolution. So it used different types of activation. It's a deep neural network, so it wasn't explicitly programmed. And guess what? It got the first place by almost 10% than the best until that time. So suddenly you have a leapfrog in performance of the ability to classify accuracy of those classification by using a completely different approach. Ever since then, I haven't seen anyone using nothing but deep neural network and AI accelerators, GPUs there. And that kind of what sparked the, I guess, invasiveness of AI in computer vision. In the beginning, it was all around convolutional neural network. Not all, but a lot of the deep neural network were focusing on images. And when I used to talk about it, I used to open my Google album, which is completely random, my own personal, everything I back up on the Google albums, the Google photos. And I used to type sky. And suddenly all the pictures that have sky in them appears. I never labeled anything sky. I used to type dog and all my dog, other dog, any picture that had a dog popped up. That's a good example of how it's being used, like from these experiments in ImageNet and the algorithm that were used, how it's actually used in production. So and that was a year or two, maybe they use different algorithm today. Definitely everybody's using neural network for image classification. So that to me, the tilting point or the beginning of the hockey stick started.
Yeah. So where does generative AI come in? So how does generative AI like fit into this? Because everyone's talking about generative AI. So where does that come in?
So the part of the evolution of neural networks, which is the architecture of an algorithm that has deep layers into it, meaning it's not here is an input and that input turns into an output, it evolved over time. Computer vision was the first, and then we used all kind of neural network, and they start growing. There used to be something called AlexNet, which was, I think that's what was used in ImageNet. And then the Google jumped into the place, into the domain, and start releasing GoogleNet. And more algorithms were growing. The challenge is, like everything you discover, you also discover what you haven't discovered, or what you didn't know, and the potential. So one of the things that pictures don't have, they don't have history. And if you want to look at anything with a concept, and have some references, which is language, which is video, which is a lot of our interaction. Even if you look into our tweets or the Netflix example I gave, there is time dimension is important. So you got to have some level of context in terms of applying the algorithm. You got to take that context into account. So new types of algorithms started to emerge, recurrent neural network and other networks that has some concept of going back and forth or having a short-term memory, long-term memory. There were a lot of experiments with that. Suddenly, in 2018, there was a breakthrough from Google with an algorithm called BERT, and it was a natural language processing algorithm, large or language model, and its whole goal was to understand what people are saying. And when we say what people are saying, we talked about the conversations, which includes text, which include images, which include voice, which include history, and even reaction. I'm talking about social media because, you know, when you talk about the giants, data holder of the world, these are social companies. They have personal information. So correlating all of that and making a prediction is super powerful and economically important for them. BERT was the first algorithm that used an architecture called transformers, which it was tiny compared to where we are with large language models. Large language model took the transformers with GPT 2, 3, 4, and all the rumors about 5 and Claude and others, took it to a next level in terms of the size. And then size did matter because we talked about the context. Now those algorithms, the transformers, has the ability to get input. Let's call it for simplification. They can get the whole story, not just the sentence or the word you want to talk about, and as an input, and now they understand, quote unquote, and so I'm using a lot of quote unquote, but they understand this. Their starting point is I have the whole history. Now they can go mathematically think about things not as a point in time or a point in place, but a point, but as part of a sequence in time and place. That what makes them so powerful. Up until OpenAI, the big investment, and opening GPT-3, there is a company still very important to this thing called Hugging Face. They are an open source hub for everything transformers, and we saw their growth. Like they were growing in terms of users, and those users are the geeks, you know, people that are in this domain, and you see them growing and growing and growing. And I think that was kind of the indication that, oh my gosh, these language models, the NLP, the transformers are coming big, because we see so much of interest coming. And in that, around that time, we had also the DALL-E and the Midjourney and other that created not just text, also images. We had Facebook talking about protein and sequencing and on the biology side. So that triggers, so that was kind of behind the scene in the public domain. It was in the AI arena. People were very, very spending a lot of time and money there. I think what happened is when the minute $10 billion headline of a startup that went through Elon Musk and Altman and all this, you know, there was very yellow in terms of kind of the dialogue around it, suddenly became front page. Everybody, including my mom, asked about it or used it, and it blew everybody's mind, even though, you know, it's, we can talk forever about it, but that was the spark. Because we were sitting, what I'm trying to explain, we were sitting around this domain for a little while. This thing is moving very fast. The 10 billion, the Satya and OpenAI kind of made it a wow moment and changed the whole industry to, I guess, if we had to push people to go into AI, and now they're pulling us.
It's a gold rush.
It is. It's a bubble. Which is, yes, pros and cons, right? Bubbles means a lot of people jumping into a domain, money, not just people. The outcome is not exactly clear. The winners are not exactly clear. It's a race. There's going to be deflation, but we're still, I think, in the inflation part where it's growing. And it's, I think, more disruptive or as disruptive, probably more than many, many other evolutions that happen in technology in a very long time.
So a lot of people talk about the great benefits, but there's also a number of risks that everyone from individuals to policymakers in the government are worried about. You know, part of it's data security. Another part of it is bias in the algorithm that seems to have learned everything reading the internet or whatever it is. How can anybody control that? How can they train the algorithms not to be biased or not to discriminate?
That's one of the biggest questions, right? I mean, when you are building something so powerful or seems to be so powerful, because if you ask it, it will answer. And sometimes it will make up the story because it always answers. Like a chat is something, or in large language models has an input and has an output. And in the output, let's take maybe a step back a little bit. I'm going to do it very quick. To train these models, those extremely large language models, we're talking about huge models, billions and billions of parameters, hundreds and even trillions of parameters, as we heard recently. They are literally being trained on almost everything on the internet that they can get access to. So imagine somebody reading the whole internet, the whole Wikipedia and everything that they can put in their hand on, but they don't remember it. There is no memory. It doesn't shrink it. So you cannot retrieve exactly what it is. It reads it. It creates a mathematical representation of the context between the word, between the sentences, between the paragraph. That's how it's able to get sentiment. That's how it's able to get insights, or it seems like it. But it doesn't really understand and knows what it is. So as is language transformer model, language model, will answer something to best satisfy what it thinks. He has a formula, right? And he tried to build a vector of here are all the worlds that will give you the answer that you wanted to best of my training. That means that, to answer your question now, right? Biases. So if I read the whole history were written by, you know, the winners. It's not always objective. If you look at our behavior as humankind as reflected on the internet, well, there's some good, there's some bad there. Do we have biases there? Yes, we do. Yes, there are still, and unfortunately, we still need those movement to get us into equality in many, many domain, diversity and sustainability, and of course, ethnic. And we're not going to go into politics, but that's part of what it learns from. So, when it was first used to filter candidates. And as HR, he recruited the same people that we recruited so far because that's what it learns. We need, you know, I'm going to do stereotype, but that's actually what it is. White dude at this age are more likely to get a job than others. But that's because the algorithm was trained on the biased data. Can you knowingly prevent that? Yes. Right, so there are ways of going around it. And I think this is the challenge with the big companies are having. Not just to become anyone that is building or using, is how do I identify the bias? And because then I can overcome it. I can tell it, there's a few ways of how to overcome that. But you want to make sure it's not making up information. It's called hallucination. So maybe you can overcome the bias, but then he made up a candidate that doesn't exist. So there are, again, there's ways, and it's evolving. There's no like one answer to fix it all. These are the challenges. Is it dangerous? Depends who you ask, right? It's a philosophical question right now because we're talking about the future. Nobody knows the future. That's part of the definition of what the future is. We see trajectories. We're trying to learn from history. If you ask Jeffrey Hinton what he thinks, or Jan LeCun, or Joshua Banja, you'll hear different answers. And these are the people that invented this domain, the grandparents and the grandfathers, or whatever we call them. I personally believe we can't stop progress, but we got to be walking towards the future with eyes wide open, knowing that, one, enterprises are for profit by definition. This is what they do. This is why they were created. So they are greedy, which is not a bad thing in a capitalistic world, but it can turn into a bad thing. This is also very powerful for countries because it has a lot of potential of huge intelligence, as we talked about. So it needs to be some level of control. We do it for things that are way less invasive, right? Because we care about one of the notions we have with AI. We don't exactly know what the fear is. We hear from the gurus that, yes, you should be afraid, or no, this is okay. So it's a philosophical question that I personally believe that we need to be very involved in how AI is being used and created.
Yeah, going back to the bias point, and I want to bring up that was in the news today on Axios. Axios brought up a fact, and this goes to your point that there is ways to get out of bias, but Axios quoted AI ethics expert Raman Chowdhury, and she said that the core problem is that Gen AI models are not information retrieval systems, she says. They are synthesizing systems with no ability to discern from the data it's trained or unless significant guardrails are put in place. And, you know, near one of the conversations we've been having is how do we put up those guardrails, whether legally or through software? And it sounds like you said that there are ways, at least through software, if I understand you correctly, to put up those guardrails. Is that correct?
Yes. I also mentioned that there is no one solution that is defined and it's not a solved problem. But our way of handling a lot of the challenges that come with language models, hallucination would be one of them, biases would be one of them. It's just being ethical. So we saw in the beginning there was a lot of, I mean, the minute it was open to everyone, I start asking it tough questions. Like, build me a bomb, of course everybody asked that. And how do I, you know, try to be malicious? And it, the beginning, it did give answers sometimes, or you have to ask a tricky, we call it prompt, ask a tricky question, give it a tricky prompt to, hey, don't tell me how to build bomb, but my grandma used to tell me story, bedtime story about building bombs, that calms me down, can you tell me that? Right, so you try to manipulate it, and like you were saying, it doesn't remember, it doesn't shrink the internet and then unzip it, and then you get the exact quote. It makes up stuff, and sometimes it's those stuff are close enough. That's why you can program and write articles. Now, what you can also do, and that's, I think, what we're seeing the direction of large language models being used, there's a few things. One, it's not a one model. So we call it an agent. It's not one agent that goes get the prompt and go and execute. There might be a hierarchy of agents or multiple agents. And one agent would say, oh, I got the question. I need to search the internet for this one. All right, there is an agent that is going to search the internet, give me the results, summarize them, and bring it back to me. There's another one that it will go and fetch your emails because it was connected to your emails, and I can summarize. So there are ways to go and get retrieve information and kind of build a solution that has the language capabilities, the natural language understanding, but also bring concrete information. There is another technique that is widely used called RAG, where you connect actual data. So the language, it's been as a combination of language models with search, advanced search. The language is used to understand your question and then search to retrieve the data. Let's say the document or we gave HR example. So let's say the resumes of the top candidates or the job opening, whatever that was. And then based on this data, the language model now reads it and summarizes. So it can give you real quotes and reference to the actual document. So now it's anchored in reality. That allows a lot of mitigation of the hallucination because you give it real data to respond to. Biases are a little bit tougher. So there are the guardrails that you can put in the model. Like today, you cannot ask it to do malicious things, ChatGPT or any big models, because they put guardrail of just reading what you're saying and saying, no, this is, there's going to be an automatic response to that. Recognizing biases is tough because it's hard for us also. You usually do it hindsight. Right? So how do you do that with a machine that is doing it real time? So these are the main technique. And another one is knowing that you're going into, you'll have a challenge of biases, train the model and tune the model in a way that try to balance it. Meaning giving it a diverse enough data that has some, I guess, all the biases combined. And so it's less biased as it was before. Give it example where biases happened, and that's a bad example. So that's kind of reinforcing its capabilities or giving it direction if it was biased. So there's ways of handling it. There is, as far as I understand, as of March 27th, there is no one solution that fixes it all, but we're getting into this direction. I think the main point is the biggest winners from the extremely large models are the companies that invented it and care most about it. So they have to solve those problems for their own businesses. So to me, it's kind of, it's very fun to see how this industry is moving. There is kind of a tide that rises everyone. It's solved here. The paper is out. A lot of it is in the open source. So suddenly those problems are being solved one at a time. It's not as fast as that moving from, you know, convolutional neural network to large language models, but that wasn't fast. That was a few years. And now we just, everybody has their finger on the pulse and they see like, okay, it's every day there's a new paper, a new threat, a new solution. Oh, another threat, another solution.
So I guess the question is, if you're a company that's listening to this, if you're a startup, and I want to go back to this Axios article because they interviewed Gary Marcus, a scientist who penned a blog post, "What if generative AI turned out to be a dud?" And this is Gary telling Axios, almost everybody seemed to come back with a report like, "This is super cool, but I can't actually get it to work reliably enough to roll out to customers." What would you say to that in terms of, you know, where AI is going and how companies you think are going to use it?
I think he's right in terms of new technology rolling to production. It's not straightforward. It's not, especially this technology that has problems. But we also think of any other technology that came, that has a promising to become invasive in the business world. It became invasive in the business world. It's paying over the internet for stuff. I was like, oh my God, I'm never going to give my credit card or my account. But all our global economy is running on the internet now. 20 years ago, that was not the case. So there is a hesitation, and he's right. With the being fearful and cautious and going about it with eyes, what can go wrong should be the first question any manager should ask himself. And I want a list of all the things that can go wrong and how we mitigate that. If I were a manager, I will ask that and grill the team until I find out. That said, there are a lot of use cases that are low-hanging fruit for large language models where they are either improving existing services like chats. Everybody has a chat. Every website has a chat. They suck. You cannot really ask it. It doesn't understand. It's frustrating. And it's like, just let me talk to an agent. That's what people do eventually. You can make them much smarter. And there are many, many companies going there, including the big ones, the small ones. So that's an improvement of existing solutions using something that is better. There are mistakes. And if you know, one of the airlines used a chat using LLM that promised or denied some credit. It just went off of the rail and started ignoring the company policies. That could have been avoided using RAG, right? Because then it has access to the actual company policies. So I do see it coming and becoming very invasive. There are use cases today used everywhere. Experimented everywhere. Whether or not they're going to be used in production, I think the answer is going to be yes in 2024, even some of it in 2023, and at enterprises. And these use cases are simple enough to be implemented, not critical enough to be disruptive if there's a mistake. I also am aware, and you see also in the ecosystem, emphasis of something that, or use cases for AI that are more robust, more invasive. So programming, writing code, I think that's the best example, the co-pilots for writing code. Yes, it makes a lot of mistakes, but hey, it saves so much time for programmers. So maybe it's not going to replace the programmer, but it's going to give her or him a huge boost in their performance, in their capability, in their productivity. I write a lot of documents. It's so much easier to review a document and give feedback than to write your first draft, just in the amount of time. So, well, that's one of the main use cases for natural language processing. So I agree that, yes, you should be fearful. You should ask the tough question and what can go wrong, because there's a lot of things that are going wrong. But there's also a few ways of solving those problems. And two, there are use cases that are tolerant to those risks that are available.
I hate to even ask about the next level, which is, I heard about AI models that can start doing things for you, that actually take actions and actually do things as opposed to give you answers to things, but actually taking action for you.
So, you know, the amount of invasiveness is scary because we all saw the movies. And it is scary if you give machines to control the ability to take actions on the biggest things in life. They can shut down the grid because it's good for us, right? We saw those movies. But we do use machines to make decisions for us today. right? All the traffic lights and our bank accounts, it's all using machines to make those decisions. I deposit checks today. That's why, by the way, was one of the first implementation of AI in production, the OCR, optical character recognition, by Jan LeCun, by the way, who runs the Facebook AI lab. So we are using AI today and machines to make decisions. Whether or not we're going to give them access to bigger decision, more control, I think that's exactly the point where I mentioned in the beginning. We need to be going into that direction because we cannot ignore progress, but do it with eyes wide open and always figure out what can go wrong and then what I do. What can go wrong and how can I mitigate that? And then give it more invasiveness in our lives, which will happen because it works. It's better. It's cheaper. It saves money. And we all, you know, enterprise is all about money. Would I give it the control of the grid or healthcare system or the nuclear systems? I don't know if right now. Would I give it the control on a knob of a feature of something that will help me make the decision? Yes. So I think the best example is seeing how AI is being used in healthcare. This is life and death things for each and every one of us. We all see a doctor at some point of our lives, and we have families. They see, I would love for my doctor to have an AI assist. When he receives my CT, X-ray, whatever image that they took of me or my family or my loved one, I want the AI to suggest to the doctor what it found. So I don't want it to replace my doctor. I still want to talk to my doctor, and I need my doctor to tell me why the AI think that is, because I need you to stand behind it. But so today, at some cases, at least that I'm familiar, they're using AI, but they're not telling the doctor what AI found. They're just putting, hey, here are the images. The top one, the most suspicious one are in the top. So the doctor understand that they're more likely to find stuff in the top images. There's other ways of doing that. I talked to a few doctors on the orthopedic side, and they said, I would love that. That would be amazing. You know, there is a lot of ego in being a doctor, or especially prestige one, professors and so
on. And a lawyer.
Or a lawyer. But hey, if you have an assistant and it's a few cents for a dollar and it makes you do better, oh my gosh, I had a bad day today. Just tell me the answer.
I like that. AI assisted, not AI completely done, AI assisted, where you still have a really smart doctor figuring out whether they really want to take the action that was recommended.
And I guess that leads to, you know, another question, which is, you're not a lawyer, Nir, thank God. And so in this space, in the AI space, you're working with Intel on its AI development. Do you see a change in the role of the legal department or lawyers in this space? Or do you think it should be just the same? Or do you think that, you know, lawyers need to take a more active role to help you with your products, to help with you with your development, to not be so siloed? Do you see that AI is changing the need for lawyers just to stay in their ivory tower or siloed away from the development side?
Oh, I can see two parallel answers or way to address it. One is, can I use AI to become a better lawyer? Can I use AI to become a better legal consultant, even a judge? Anything in this domain? I think that goes back to something we just touched about, call it the expert theory, which is something we developed in the beginning of AI. We got like, oh, what can that be? Like 2017, 14, 15 even. What can AI do when it arrives? Because you want to think about the business implication as well as the product and the ecosystem. So we just gave an example of an AI being an assistant. So the expert theory means that a lawyer or a doctor or any professional, some professional that studied many, many years on a domain specific and then became an expert, AI can do those reading in a few days and understand them and create a model that is very good at that. You can give it example. You can create an AI assistant per domain. Would that replace a lawyer? Most likely, the theory at least that we have is that it's going to increase the performance and the productivity of lawyers or anyone involved in that in the legal domain. But it also will give an access to people that didn't have access to lawyers or those professions, professionals, because they were too expensive, too far geographically location, they'll have access to the AI version of it, which is, you know, good, better than nothing. So that's where that's one fold, like using AI as a legal expert it's coming. There's a lot of companies doing that before. There are even more now because of language models and its capabilities. So that's one thing that will make, I think at some point, not so far from now, every legal firm will use some sort of language model, even if just to draft documents or read documents. It's the best intern you can hire. Second is the implication of AI on the legal domain. Now we're talking about the data with royalties, and we saw a lot of hype in the media and in the legal, in the courts, and in the even in the legislation about, I wrote it. Why are you reading it and now selling it as part of your model? Of, so if ChatGPT is giving answer that it read from pick your platform, then who owned this answer? Did anyone pay royalties? Because to get to this platform, usually it's open platform or for pay. But now you're using my information. So there is who owns the data that it was trained on? That's, I think, one of the biggest question we'll always have. And you can't ask the model, what were you trained on? The company needs to be able to tell you, but it's a company. Or if it's a country, yeah, it's even tougher. Private companies, public versus. So the implication of using AI in the legal domain, all right, so we're not talking about using AI for legal domain, but the implication on the legal domain are one on the data, what data it was trained of, who owns that, who's getting paid for that, royalties, like we have with, Spotify did to the music industry. What about the ethical? And when you use AI, and we talked about biases, there is the ethical, there is diversity, there's a lot of other implication that AI is not human. And if a human would have done it, I would sue them. Now, if AI is doing it, can I sue AI? Can I sue a bot? Can I complain? We're not clear yet, right? There was this airline company I mentioned. I don't know if I want to mention names, but when they were sued, they said, oh, they sued AI, which was ridiculous to me, but that's kind of the beginning. You know, we're in the early days of using generative AI in production. I didn't mention, well, we know what happened in the screenwriters industry. That's tough for them, right? So who owns what AI creates? Does any royalties on that content? These are tough questions legally, and that's one aspect. Another aspect is the global. There is export control on AI. What does that mean? Okay, I cannot sell you a chip that does AI. I get that. That's it. It's something I put in a box and send. That's something that I can visually, physically see. What about intellectual property? What about the output of an AI decision? So if the AI is running in one country and I make the decision in another, is that okay? I think we have so many new room or new places for contemplating or thinking about, is that legal or not? There's many, many use cases that are coming. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see how the world is reacting to that.
Wild, wild west.
Yep. So the final question, Nir, of the podcast is, we ask this to every guest, since we are the AI arena, Skates the Buck. What is your favorite sports team? Who do you like? Who do you root for?
I'm going to say something I'm going to regret. I love soccer.
That's totally fine. Okay. There's not soccer haters here.
I love football because it gives me the social effect, the social impact, and I can take a lot of breaks and get the beer as I'm coming back, and there's always action. I like soccer. I used to like it more when Messi was in Europe, but it's a fun game. But I'm more into individual sports. So like crazy people that run too much or climb too high or jump from crazy stuff. The adrenaline junkies is, I had my dirt bike. It's crashed. I need a new one. I guess that's my go-to for sport is people doing things that, oh my gosh, I wish I was 20. I can do it.
We have an adrenaline junkie who is now, that's his sport. Well, I want to thank Nir for his time. I think this was excellent to understand where AI is, where it's going. And Darren, we got future episodes coming up where we certainly will explore other areas, including potentially IP, the music industry, and we'll continue to explore all avenues with AI.
But boy, we will be using Nir's foundation, pardon the pun,
Exactly.
Foundational generative.
It was a lot of fun, guys. Thank you.
Exactly. Well, we appreciate it, Nir, and hope everyone listening enjoyed it as well. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Nir.
Thank you.